I am generally a multifamily guy. I love multifamily. I think there is so much wealth to be had in multifamily, especially today. And we can talk about some of the economic reasons for that. But the challenge with multifamily is finding the right asset, right? And paying for it. And the problem I see with multifamily, it's not valued correctly as a business. When you go and purchase a business or you shop for a business, it's valued. There's a number of inputs, but it's valued on a multiple of revenue, a multiple of operating income, you know, and headache factor. A multifamily is valued on what the income is going to look like in 4 years.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm very excited to introduce our guest for the day, Serge Shukat. Serge, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Suja. It's a pleasure. My pleasure.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited to get into your story and hear all about your business. You've got a lot going on. Why don't you start us off with telling us a bit about your background and how you got into the real estate space and also why?
So originally from California, was a corporate warrior, and my story's out there in a number of podcasts. I won't go into too much detail. It's pretty easy to find, but I was working the rat race, knew it wasn't for me, inherently was a buyer and seller of things, was always doing stuff on the side, making side income, kind of the side hustle. And the side hustle just always evolved into something. And I was always a watcher of the market, I would call it, where, you know, staying up on current events, seeing kind of the stuff that was going on around me. And in my early 20s, I had seen a number of cycles, business cycles, specifically the internet, .com bubble burst, the asset collapse in some specific countries with the long-term capital management and kind of the effect that that had. The early 90s real estate correction, let's call it, that affected the Bay Area. And I saw all this stuff going on around me. I didn't have money to do anything, but I saw that in 91, the house was worth 200. And then in 96, it was worth 800. And I was like, huh, and I kind of took note of that. And then the dot-com collapse, that Oracle stock was 300 in 2000, you know, and it was 90 in 2001. And I was like, huh, you know, I took kind of note of that. When's a good time to buy? When's a good time to sell? And so by the time the 2007, 8, 9 correction happened, and it happened to real estate, I just happened to be in Arizona. The company I worked with was purchasing a consolidating with another company. I was sent out to Mesa, Arizona to lead that transition, fell in love with the place and ended up staying, you know, lower cost of living compared to California. And right there at that time, the real estate collapse happened and just evolved the side hustle to that. Started buying single families, bought one, refinanced it, took some cash out, bought two, rented it, learned the rental game, the long-term leases and the property management software and all the fun stuff that came with that. Learned what can be profitable, what couldn't. And slowly evolved that until it replaced my day income, my corporate income. And my corporate job phased out anyways. We sold the company to a larger company, and I made the transition in 2012, 13, full-time into real estate, and have been constantly evolving and changing and pivoting, you know, the asset class and the stuff that we buy. So we are where we are today.
That's awesome. What a great story. I think a lot of us can relate to that. And curious to hear the rest of your corporate warrior stories. We'll all have to go look those up. And wondering, how did you learn, you know, in 2007, 2008, when you were noticing it's a good time to buy,
How did you start to learn? Was it just by experience? Were you seeking education?
You know, back then it was a little bit more difficult. There were some platforms like BiggerPockets that were just starting. You know, there were forums and some people that shared knowledge there. So I'd reach out to some people there that were doing, I'd find people on keywords that were doing a lot of the same stuff that I was doing. I had a friend from high school and college whose dad was a full-time real estate investor. And I recalled growing up that I was always impressed that anytime I went to his house, his dad was there. Dad had a big house, you know, in a nice area. And he was always, you know, working on family stuff, going to family football games or stuff around the house. He was always there. Whereas my parents growing up, they were always working. They were always working. They'd come home at 6 o'clock. They were tired. And I saw that difference. And whenever I'd ask, what does your dad do? Oh, he rents houses, you know, kind of stuck with me. So I, you know, I'd go to him to find out, you know, where do I get a lease template? You know, what kind of house should I buy? What neighborhood should I buy? But the majority of it was really trial and error. I'm a guy that if I can visualize it, if I can see that the numbers work on paper, I'm going to jump in. And I was frantically searching for something that would displace my day job. I knew that I wasn't going to go into an office and stare at a computer and make corporate shareholders rich with my labor. That's just wasn't going to be what I was going to do. And I always thought it was going to be a website or web development and something along those lines, but it turned out to be real estate. And what a blessing that turned out to be.
It's such a great vehicle for buying back your time and having freedom of schedule and life by design. So makes a lot of sense.
And that's the why. You asked what the why was. The why was that life by design. You know, by the time in 2012, I had one daughter, she was 4, and I didn't want her seeing me going to work every day. I didn't want to go to work every day. I wanted to be there. So that was the why.
Yeah, totally. That's so cool that you are able to be more present with your kids, thanks to real estate and the path that you chose. And just a quick question about the, you knowing you weren't going to be using your labor to make corporate shareholders rich. Like, was that just something that you knew from the time you were a kid? How did that grow and develop in you? Just that knowing that you didn't want to be in that system.
I'll tell you exactly how. So my dad, so we are first generation immigrants that immigrated in 1979. I was a baby. My dad and my mom came to this country not knowing a word of English. My dad had a higher education in nuclear engineering and landed with Pacific Gas and Electric fairly early from the Soviet Union, a nice, stable job, the American dream, right? And his job was designing nuclear power plants, right? And this was in the early 80s. And he had probably what seemed back then the most stable job you can have. You know, get dressed, come into work at 8 a.m., do your thing, come home, and there's always going to be a need for energy, right? Well, in the mid-90s, by the time I was in high school, nuclear energy was no longer popular. They were closing down plants. So he lost his job. And these were very formative years for me. I watched him lose his job. I watched him at home trying to find a new job. I watched my mom support the family, and I watched him unable to find a job in that industry and have to completely retrain into a new field. And he did, you know, and kudos to him. He learned computer programming and he went and got a job at Oracle, right? And I watched how hard he had to work because he was competing against 20-year-old guys that were doing computer programming since they were born, basically. And here you have a mid to late 40s. Everything's slower, learning, reading. And I remember his books. He had, you know, 60 books that were probably the binding was 10 inches, you know, that he had to comb through and read and learn. And he stayed up. He worked there late. He'd come home and he'd work. He'd have to work double the hours of the younger guys. And they kept pressing and pressing and pressing. And what happened after that? He lost his job there. You know, the first time, you know, they missed earnings, they downsized. They moved his development team to, another place, and he was gone. And so that was very formative for me. I said to myself in that moment, that's not going to be me. I'm not losing a job on somebody else's whim and having somebody else in the family have to rely on where the money's coming from. That's not happening. And so I knew that I couldn't jump directly to that. It's kind of a little bit of a difference between today's generation. They think they can jump just directly into entrepreneurship. And a lot of that has to do with social media and some of those things they see, how fast people make money. But I knew that I had to pay my dues. I had to go to college. I had to learn a skill. But I always knew it was going to be temporary. I always knew it was an ends to a means. And I always knew that I was playing the face game until I found something better. Whereas he was 100% dedicated to that company and giving that company his all. No company was ever going to get that from me.
Yeah, very powerful stuff. Thank you for sharing that bit of your family history. You just mentioned something which I find to be a very interesting topic and want to circle back to it, which is, you know, when you said this generation thinks that they can jump straight into entrepreneurship. And I just want you to expand on that, if you don't mind, like what is going on in terms of, you know, the narrative about jumping into entrepreneurship versus like needing to gain skills, et cetera.
Well, you've seen it. You've seen it, right? YouTube channels, right? YouTube channel millionaires. Keeping Up with the Kardashians, right? I have a 15-year-old daughter. She sees it. She watches these people. She watches these brands. They think that it comes easy. And I'm trying to explain, look, even that YouTube millionaire that seems like TikTok millionaire, that seems like they've made all this money out of nothing, they had to learn how to edit. They had to learn how to market themselves. They had to learn what clothes to dress. It didn't come overnight, but they only see how it did come overnight. Right. When I was growing up, there were no overnight success stories. We were always taught it was for us. The overnight success story was Bill Gates dropped out of college. Right. But he still went to Harvard. He still had to get accepted to Harvard. He still had to make friends at Harvard and get the ideas. It wasn't that he went from high school junior to CEO of Microsoft. Right. So today there is not even a drop out of college. It was he's a sophomore in high school and he's got millions of dollars. And I'm trying to teach these kids that, first of all, you don't know that he has $1 million. And second of all, even if he does, he's got a select skill set that didn't come overnight. He developed that skill set. Maybe he was working that skill set since he was a babe, right? But that's a difficult message because it's an instant society today. It's everything. They want it now, you know? And I have more examples. I have, you know, a neighbor's son that I've, you know, spent a little bit of time, you know, mentoring, and some other younger folks that I've mentored, and I try to get them slowly involved in the business. And I give them some mundane tasks, you know, I'll put them into the business and give them, you know, tasks that are data entry related. You can't get them to do that for 10 minutes. For 10 minutes. I don't want to do it. I'm not interested in this business. And it's like, how else are you going to learn this business? There's so many intricate steps. And when I was that age, I would do data entry for hours. Just show me somebody that was willing to pay me. I would do it. I would reconcile schedules, tax returns for day traders, you know, with 5,000 transactions. I would sit there for 10 hours a day for 50 hours doing it for them for $100, you know? And the valuable lesson that I keep saying over and over again is the value is in the knowledge, not the money. Who cares about the money? Getting paid for tasks is the worst thing you can do. It teaches somebody to be on a leash. $10 an hour is not life-changing. I tell my daughter, what are you going to make? So you work 50 hours. Even if I paid you $20, $30, $50 an hour. Okay, what is that going to buy you? Well, it's going to buy me Lululemon tights. Okay. Great. Now what? You're a slave to that money. Learn the knowledge, develop that knowledge, and you can create the next Lululemon or whatever they like, you know? So it's a difficult message to teach today with all the distractions. It really is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can relate to that on some level for sure. I mean, I feel like the antidote to that is just not being supported by your parents anymore, like once you graduate from college and having to actually get a job, right? I don't know. What do you think the antidote is going to be for your kids?
It's so unbelievably challenging because the way these kids grow up and what they see, you know, when they see dad come home in a new Tesla, like it's nothing, and they think it's nothing. And then when they go to school and other kids are like, wow, you got this and you got that, they slowly start realizing they have things that other kids don't have. Wow, what's the lesson? You know, for me, my lessons were seeing my family struggle, seeing that when we went to the store, that the answer was no to everything I wanted. I didn't even ask for stuff. I knew the answer was no. You know, these kids, when the answer is no, they throw a fit because why is it no? You can afford it. They know you can afford it. So the answer is no, because you're trying to teach them a lesson, but what's the lesson? So the answer is seeing the hard work, involving them in the hard work, taking them to the sites, right? Taking them to the apartment complexes and going through a collection. Like, you know, I'll take my daughters to a apartment, an eviction where they've left everything. And I don't know if you've done that before, right? But generally, when you have a tenant that's been evicted and they've left everything, their life was a wreck. So you're going to see vodka bottles. You're going to see cribs, right? Right next to the vodka bottle, right? So you see a crib that's unmade, a vodka bottle, toys, all in one room. That's a powerful message, right? This tenant lost his house and is probably homeless because of the bad decisions that they made, because they didn't value the knowledge, because they only went after that $15, right? The value of the knowledge is the college, right? You go to college and you pay for the knowledge. Nobody's paying you to learn, right? So the lesson comes slow. Sometimes it's never learned, but I struggle with it just like everybody else. It's you just don't know. And some kids pick it up sooner than others. But really, it's usually a traumatic event that they see that enforces that message. And we haven't had that traumatic event.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, so it's a challenge. It's a challenge, no doubt.
Yeah, it makes sense because, I mean, you know, when you grow up seeing hardship and sort of like a lack of financial, you know, abundance, in a sense, then you're more motivated, right? And so when it's kind of already, you already have it, it's a very interesting question because people talk in this industry a lot about generational wealth and how, you know, we want to build generational wealth, but then the lessons, right, that need to be transferred to the kids. It's like, how do you transfer not just the wealth, but the lessons? So obviously you're working on it and I'm excited to see, you know, what you learn as you continue on that journey. Okay, great. So you're obviously doing a ton of stuff, Serge, in the real estate space. Let's talk about that. I know you're currently working on a bunch of hotel conversions, which I'm really curious about. Will you tell us about, you know, what that looks like and what sorts of issues you're working through?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
I am generally a multifamily guy. I love multifamily. I think there is so much wealth to be had in multifamily, especially today. And we can talk about some of the economic reasons for that. But the challenge with multifamily is finding the right asset, right? And paying for it. And the problem I see with multifamily, it's not valued correctly as a business. When you go and purchase a business or you shop for a business, it's valued. There's a number of inputs, but it's valued on a multiple of revenue, a multiple of operating income, you know, and headache factor. A multifamily is valued on what the income is going to look like in 4 years, in 5 years. And so is a business to an extent. Don't get me wrong. A business, if you know you can buy a business and turn it and do a lot of stuff, so you'll pay a higher multiple, maybe a little bit higher multiple. There really aren't any other asset classes or business where the premise is I'm going to buy it today and I'm going to pay the value that I think it's going to be in 5 years based on these renovations, based on all this hard work that I do. How does that work? If I got to do all this hard work, why am I paying a multiple of the work that I got to do? That was always something that didn't sit right with me. And so in my career as a multifamily investor, it was always hard for me to buy stuff because I'm looking at it, you know, I'm looking at a 60 unit apartment complex that has 200,000 NOI. And I'm saying, I'll give you a prevailing cap rate on the business that you're doing on the 200,000, right? But the broker's telling me, no, you're going to have to pay a small cap rate on the business that you're going to do in 2 years on a 400 cap rate that he never proved that can even happen. And that didn't sit well with me because by doing that, I'm assuming exponential risks. I'm assuming construction risks that I can do the construction. I'm assuming macroeconomic risks that rents will continue to go up. I'm assuming regional risks that the population isn't going to decline, right? So by buying assets at a multifamily assets but on a pro forma of future NOI, I'm assuming 3 to 5 times the risks, right? And a lot of multifamily investors are okay with that because they've been okay doing that for so long. We've had a run for so long, 10 years, 15 years, I mean, since you know, if you bought something anytime between 2009 to 2020, you made a lot of money anytime. We haven't really had a stretch run like that before. So everybody's lulled into this form of buying. What I found, so it led me to look at a lot of different asset classes. And the way I learned to do that was from the experience with the single family. I was constantly pivoting in single family. When the recession first hit, we were buying in Phoenix, Mesa, Chandler, really nice population growth centers. Well, it took about 6 months to a year before investors woke up, and those prices jumped from 2009 to 2011 distressed prices. They doubled. So we pivoted and went to secondary markets, right? Purchased there, and the run was longer there. The run was 4 or 5 years. And then investors woke up and bought there. Wall Street woke up at that point and bought those. So we pivoted to tertiary markets, military towns, and bought there. And everyone said those markets will never wake up. And then those woke up. So the pivoting never ends in real estate. And what we're trying to buy is different assets on different points in the business cycle. Right now, multifamily, in my opinion, clearly at one of the high points in the business cycle, right? It can continue going up, but we're not at the bottom of the business cycle. We know that. So hotels were the closest thing to apartments. They're really the same thing. They're boxes. They're boxes with plumbing and electricity, right? Same thing. They're boxes that are used for housing. What's the real difference? They're furnished and some are smaller, okay? So I thought it was natural. I thought it was completely natural to pivot to that, but it never sat well because, again, it's a different asset class. You got to learn it. So you learn it slowly. So what we did was take the multifamilies that we already had and made them mini hotels. So took a 60 unit and put 5 on the market, ran them as Airbnbs, learned all the things that furnished guests want, how to market to OTAs, how to use pricing, learned all of it slowly on 1 unit, 2 units. 3 units. So then when a hotel broker calls and says, well, what's the real difference? You know, let's learn to underwrite what a hotel is. So then it started looking at those, and it became kind of a no-brainer when you're looking at the same 36,000 square feet, which a multifamily investor is going to want to pay, you know, is going to want to pay $10 million for. Here's a broker calling you saying, take the same 36,000 square feet and buy it for $1.5 million on a different point in the business cycle. So knowing what we knew with Airbnb, with furnished, with long-term leases, say, why not try it? Why not try it? So it was the same thing. So we bought our first one pre-COVID into COVID, did the renovations during COVID, and leased it up, right? Excuse me, 1 second. We grew at that point from that original 70 unit into 3 additionals, 168 unit in Phoenix, which was a former Marriott Residence Inn, a 70 unit in Tempe, which was a former Hawthorne Suites, and a 100 unit in Chandler, Arizona. And these are all A+ prime locations.
And so your plan with those was to convert them from hotel to, or do some kind of mixed between a hotel and multifamily, or long-term or short-term?
First one was going to be full multifamily, and that was the business plan, full multifamily conversion. We got the entitlements about a month in, did a tiny renovation. These were all studios with kitchens and one bedrooms. Half of them were one bedroom, so they was already perfectly set up for it. It had no, it was interior corridor, but had no specific, you know, no specific amenities, or it was set up to be a decent multifamily already. Renovated 15 units as specials, right? And those were set out to be the Airbnbs. The rest I gave to the property manager. The property manager went out to lease them up, and they took a really, really long time. They took 6 months. They had maybe 15. And what happened was they were taking so long to lease up that we said, we're just going to put all of them, you know, we're just going to list all of them, listed all of them. And it became a really nice complementary balance that, you know, would be filled in between multifamily, as many as they could lease. When they couldn't lease them, it would just go right back onto our calendar. And it, and the end result was a 70 unit property that would have done as a pure multifamily, probably $45,000 a month. So let's call it $550. Let's call it $550 would have been its peak maximum gross revenue. And that would have been about a $300,000 NOI. That's how I underwrote it. And with a five cap, that's a $6 million property, right? As a multifamily. This was a $1.5 million purchase, and that's what it was worth as a hotel, because they were doing like $100,000 NOI. With a hotel, you got to do $1.25 million. You got to operate it really good to maybe squeak out $250 NOI, because expenses are so high as a hotel. So you buy it on the hotel, a high cap rate on a low NOI, and you sell it on a high cap rate on a high NOI. So today I underwrote it as a $300,000 NOI, and today it's doing $750 top line. Yeah, and $450 NOI. And it's we just listed it for $6.5 million. I'm not even getting credit for the full $450 NOI. We're going to market like at a $400 NOI pro forma, because I'm not getting full credit for my vacation rentals. Maybe a little bit more detail than you asked for, but
that's definitely really interesting. And, you know, we were talking before the show about some of the questions that people will come to you with when they're looking at these kind of hybrid properties. And maybe now's a good time to just like sort of break some of those questions down. Like, you know, what do you do with the furniture if you want to switch it from a short term to a long term, and utilities, et cetera?
So take them one by one. What's the most pressing question?
Okay. So what do you do with the furniture? Because you said, well, maybe we'll switch it from a short term to a long term or back.
Okay. So if you're going one, so the first decision point is it going to be a hotel, hybrid, or multifamily? Okay. That's going to tell you what to do with the furniture. That's going to answer your question. If it's a multifamily, furniture goes by, you can make 3 phone calls to, you know, these resettlement organizations or Salvation Army, and be done with it, right? If it's a hybrid, you keep the furniture in the ones you're going to do short term. And if it's a pure hotel, you keep all the furniture. That easy.
Okay. But like, I thought you said like sometimes, like, you know, you're adding units. So sometimes you'll do 4 units, then 5 units, then 6 units as short-term rentals. So are you storing any extra furniture, or are you just buying it new?
So that's where it gets challenging. Yeah. So that's where it gets challenging. So for me, what I ended up doing was keeping all the furniture and doing furnished rentals. So that specific market, the first one that we did, and all of them, so for us, we keep the furniture, and even the long-term rentals are furnished rentals.
Okay. So what about the utilities? Like, are you paying for all utilities? Are you doing any sort of...
Yep.
Okay.
So utilities will always be all-inclusive. And so we'll do furnished long-term leases. So for example, in the Phoenix property, the property manager does 6-month minimum leases, furnished rentals. They'll have about a $250 to $500 premium to the market. So they'll be seasonal as well. So they'll go up to a $500 premium during the 4 months of the season, $250 premium. There's probably a lot of room there, off season, 6-month minimum furnished with rubs, as you'd have on a multifamily. So the goal there is you want to be able to have a multifamily quote unquote rent roll. When you go to sell the property, it's really important that you have a multifamily rent roll and that you have a multifamily P&L, that you have a P&L that, you know, you can tie back to a rent roll and all that, because your buyer right now is really going to be homogeneous. It's going to most likely be a syndicator that's buying with other people's money that knows how to buy one way and under one formula. So you're serving it up to that meat.
I also was wondering, what is your general thoughts on, you know, like the sort of overall space of hotels and hospitality. I know you do vacation rentals as well. So like, do you see these hotels as just no longer being relevant in the hospitality market?
Oh, I got a lot of thoughts on this topic. And I talk to a lot of people about this because I have a lot of friends in the hotel business now. I'm got kind of ingrained in the Arizona community. I know kind of a lot of the owners and the brokers. I personally think hospitality is in the way it's being done, is an obsolete business. I think that the brands and the franchise model is unsustainable, completely unsustainable. The hotels that I've purchased had brands. I've studied their financial statements, and the amount of risk they take is, in my mind, outrageous. I have a few friends that are hotel builders, and they have land, and they're asking me, should I build a hotel? And I'm telling them, you're insane to build a hotel. I'm sorry if this is controversial, I offend anybody.
It's okay.
But I run through the numbers in just in my head, or, you know, verbalize them on what a hotel build, lease up, NOI, and exit, those four stages look like, and what an apartment build, entitlement, build, lease up, NOI, exit. Do talk both of those out and see which one makes sense. It's that simple. And if you can build a hotel, you can build multifamily. A multifamily is a much better model today. 5 years ago, the hotel was the better model for the bang for the buck. I mean, you were doing double the NOI. People were paying. Cap rates were low. Remember, in 2019 was the best year the hospitality industry ever had for ADR, all of their metrics. So people were buying nice urban hotels for the same cap rates as hotel as a multifamily. It's just post COVID that the cap rates have diverged significantly. Always hotels and tertiary markets or beat down or exterior corridors. Those were always 10 caps, you know, because not as many people wanted to own them. But a nice interior corridor Marriott, you know, you were paying a 5 cap, and just as you were a nice in a primary market over 1.5 million MSA, you're paying the same 5 cap, right? Today, you're paying a 3 cap on multifamily and an 8-10 cap on hotel. And to run it as a hotel, ask the Marriott owners in Houston how that went for them. You know, look at all the foreclosures right now. You know, look at all the foreclosures. They still haven't reopened cruising out of Galveston.
Yeah. But you still like the hospitality industry. It's just that you don't, let me see if I'm getting this right, but doing just a pure hotel in with the big boxes, that to you seems risky.
The franchise model, cleaning rooms every single day, providing breakfast. And by the way, they're all waking up to this. They all know this already. They're all waking up to this. There's a lot of lawsuits. You talk to hoteliers, they'll tell you they know this, you know, they're not dumb. But this model post COVID, what I like, I do like hospitality. I like the revenue of hospitality. I like the top line. I love the top line. I'm doing hospitality. My two properties have I'm not doing them with a property manager, with a multifamily property manager. I don't have a multi-property manager rent roll. So I'm risking my exit chasing the NOI, right? On these two properties. I'm doing that. But that's how bullish I am in hospitality, doing it how I'm doing it.
Yeah, for sure.
Automated with VAs, completely automated process, no 24/7 front desk, no food, beverage, restaurant, meeting hall, limited to no service, offices closed on the weekends. My tagline, my motto is hospitality revenue with multifamily expenses. That's how I roll.
Totally. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I didn't mention this earlier, but my primary bread and butter is through basically short-term rentals. And I basically just take the profits from that and put it into other, you know, LP investments. But, so it's definitely that automation and the amount of money that you can get without having to actually run a hotel is really great.
So think about this. You do vacation rentals on houses. What's your asset class?
I have 2-bedroom apartments and studios.
There you go. So take your studios and your 2-bedroom apartments, right? And think about the revenue you're doing in Portland, right? So what, a studio in Portland, you're probably doing what, 35,000 to 45,000 gross?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Think about how you've been able to automate that. right? Through Airbnb, through pushing to the platforms, through your locks, through your leases, all the stuff you do, where you have no touch points where people come in and out. I don't know. Maybe you have a lot of touch points.
No, still, I don't.
Probably not. Right.
But I have automated messaging and such. So
exactly. So now think about, since COVID hit, how much stronger your business has become, and think about how your relationship has changed or not changed with your guests, right? Now consider the multifamily owner that is stuck in long-term 12-month leases. How did his relationship change? Watching the CDC, watching the CDC, what's going on there? Can I evict? Can I not evict? What regulation is coming out, down the pipeline, right? You don't care what regulation, no one, that hasn't affected you.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
Your guest extends for a week, for a month, for 2 months, he stops paying. What do? You change the codes. You're not going in front of a judge. Yeah, maybe you get a liberal judge that lets him stay for another 6 months, or New York, you know, you hear, I mean, it's insane. I read those stories. I don't want anything to do with that business.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks so much for all of the value that you've provided. We talked about a lot of different things, and it's really great to have you on. Please take a moment to share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and anything else you want to share.
Yeah. They can find me pretty easy on LinkedIn, reach out, you know, send a hello. I talk to a lot of people about real estate all day.
Yeah. I hope you reach out to Serge. And Serge, thanks so much for coming on. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.